The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.
Rock on, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his parole officer, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 46 of The Big Picture for the week beginning February 14. And coming up in today's show, Brooklyn, the love affair that spans two continents and three accents.
Marvel's most cynical superhero arrives. Hello, Deadpool.
And in the run-up to Easter, we get all resurrection-y with a top five comeback film.
Dun, dun, dun. All coming up in the show. And for the record, I'm not on parole. Thank you, Mark.
No, because we moved past that difficult stage in your life and we're just happy as people now.
Yeah, mate. Always good to see you too. Just move on to this week. What's around? Oh, I'm up first to tell us all that Zoolander 2 is at cinemas. And I'm pretty miffed. Mark, I'm miffed that before this show, I have not as yet seen the sequel to one of our favorite comedies. And there are plenty of people out there are down with Zoolander. Very keen to see the return. I'm not sure they ever should have made it, but I want to go and find out for myself. Zoolander 2 is at cinemas everywhere.
Don't worry, we'll come up with something to make it better later in the show. Look, this week saw the kickoff of the Nine Network's new racially slanted Here Come the Habibs. There's nothing's going to go wrong with that program. You know what I mean? Tuesday is now home to a Lebanese version of Kingswood Country, but that was, that was nothing.
Welcome back, Kingswood Country.
But that's nothing to Seven's launch last Sunday of Molly, which had an amazing 1.7 million viewers, and episode 2 is on tonight at 8:30. But before you switch off, just remember you can catch it on Plus 7 after The Big Picture.
On DVD and Blu-ray and all those kind of things, The Martian has landed. All-star cast, a splendid story of being stranded, surviving, and salvation. It's like Castaway in space, but with Matt Damon. The Martian is on Blu-ray and DVD right now.
My favourite comedy musical. Okay. Also big on 7 this week, the final series of Downton Abbey kicks off tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Yes, season 6 is finally upon us. Be still my beating heart.
Yawny heart.
We've got much more to say about this, but look, hang on till later in the show.
I can't wait, mate. Last Sunday, the Super Bowl was on, that massive American gridiron caper, and one movie scored a game-winning emotional touchdown, Mark. It was the new 30-second trailer for Jason Bourne, which, speaking of Matt Damon news, Matt Damon's in the news all over this week.
It's
Jason Bourne, as in the Bourne series is returning, and Matt Damon's going to be in it. A 30-second clip was at the Super Bowl. You know, Super Bowl every year is massive time for unveiling movies and ads. So much money goes into that thing. But apparently, according to those who are keeping watch and Twitter and experts and that sort of thing, Jason Bourne was the thing last Sunday. So who knows? But hopefully, the film's going to be able to live up to its 30-second Super Bowl trailer.
All they need to do is put a whole lot of those 30 seconds together. Okay. Well, it seems that even Steven Spielberg has to make way for greater things these days. His upcoming film, Ready Player One, it's an adaptation of Ernest Cline's best-selling fantasy novel, has had to move from December 2017 to the less salubrious March 2018.
No one's talking about March 2018.
No, not anymore. No. Because he's got to steer clear of Star Wars Episode 8.
Oh, okay. A little movie we like to call Episode 8. Like that.
Apparently, it's just too big for even Spielberg to take on.
Wow. Now, something that is never too big for me to take on, Mark, is one of our new segments on the show, True or False. I believe you have a true or false proposition to put to us, and we've got to work out whether it is indeed true or is indeed false.
Yes, and you must do so in 5 seconds.
Okay. Right. My time starts now. Go.
Okay. It's an epic week, and later in the show, we're going to be looking at would-be epic Risen, Hollywood's return to the golden age of cinema, and that tackles the story of Jesus and his resurrection. So I thought it'd be a great time to have a look at one of the epics in cinema and see how we go with the true or false. True or false, Ben? Marlon Brando received the Academy Award for Best Actor in his performance as The Godfather at the 45th Academy Awards in 1973. True or false? Marlon Brando received the Academy Award for Best Actor. You might think this sounds simple.
It does sound simple, and I really want to throw out an answer off the top of my head. You gave me 5 seconds.
No, I'm going to give you the entire break. Let's move on to what your kids are watching.
All right, and we'll come back to that true or false afterwards. Okay, keep thinking. On to what your kids are watching. Former reality TV show contestants, Mark, former reality TV show hosts, aging AFL stars, up-and-coming Iron Women, current Neighbours characters, and legendary Prisoner stars, and Shane Warne. What format could possibly bring such a diverse bunch of TV glitterati together? This week in What Your Kids Are Watching, we're taking a look at I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Well, actually, Mark's taking a look at that. He's taking a look at it for all of us, where everyone has a charity support and apparently an axe to grind.
Just shush for a sec. I just want to try and do this.
Oh, it just makes you happy to watch me gag.
Is there any way you could try?
It's got maggots on it. I can't. I'm sorry. I'm not eating maggots.
That was really disrespectful to not only Shane, but to both me and Dean.
If I find myself in that situation, no matter what, yep, I'm just going to try and encourage the person doing it.
He has been the coldest person here.
We're all missing our food.
Rats in a glass and like some really yummy cheese.
Theoretically, we could have a mutiny.
Yuck!
Oh no.
I just want to cut it up. You can just cut it up.
Ow!
It'd be okay being here if there were different rules, huh?
We abduct Julia Morris. Revolution!
All right, mates, let's cut straight to the heart of this matter. Do these people actually qualify for celebrity status as the title of the show would suggest?
Well, for those people who are wondering what it is, the show is basically take a bunch of celebrities and stick them in the Kruger National Park in South Africa and then, you know, do horrible things to them. And apparently it's even more interesting because they're celebrities, right? Are they celebrities? Okay, some of them clearly are. Like Shane Warne is an international name. So there you go. There's one. Val Lehman. You might not know the name straight away, but I bet you know Queen Bee from Prisoner.
Okay? Oh, yeah, yeah.
She's 72 now.
Wow, she went off to Kruger National Park
to do than sit in the jungle.
Okay. Is it like Survivor?
Yeah, it is so much like Survivor that there was a court case when it was first introduced in America. It was because it was basically sued for being too much like
That's
Survivor.
That's way too similar.
I know.
Yeah.
Anyway, Paul Harrigan from The Footy Show, Joe Beth Taylor, look. But then you got to get the other people in, okay, who are sort of balancing out more than the majority. Lauren Fleur.
How many people are there?
13.
And how many weeks? This goes for 13 weeks, and
yeah,
I take
it. And week by week, we're knocking them out. And we've gotten rid of somebody already. But
and look, do people vote them out of the national park?
You basically have fun along the way. You text people to do terrible things to them. And eventually, you text them off the show.
They've got texting in the national park?
No, sorry.
We're the viewer.
The viewer have all the power, apparently.
Oh, so that's okay. The spin on Survivor then. There's nothing similar at all about this show. So to answer my question, Mark, are these celebrities? Or so you think in the bulk, no.
Well, Lauren Fleur from Bachelorette. Okay. Dean Guy, third place Australian Idol contestant. Akmal Seller, an Australian-Egyptian comedian.
That guy's kind of funny.
People clearly looking, though, to push a profile, okay, one that might have been lagging for a fair while now.
Yeah, and a charity, as we mentioned in the intro. We'll get back to that. It sounds super formulaic, like we've seen all this before, but just insert celebrities here. How's it performing? Is it doing all right in the ratings?
It's actually doing incredibly well.
This
is 7:30 p.m. Okay, so this is actually pitched at a much younger
7:30
audience.
7:30 every night of the week?
Yeah, it's weeknights from Monday to Friday.
Is it?
Yeah, and so basically...
Wow. So it's like Big Brother, Survivor, and celebrities all crammed
much
into one.
It is. It's every reality show you never wanted to see. All there, so you can
but
watch
some people
it
do. But some 1. People do.
1.3 million
That's
people.
That's some lots of people
yeah
really do.
That said, okay, ratings have been dropping. We're really into our second week. When it opened January 31, it was 1.3 million. By the time it got to February 4th, it had gone under a million. And, well, you know, we'll just see as very things come forward. Look, the highlights, what is worth seeing, Shane Warne drank a pureed rat.
that is TV gold.
Oh,
I actually wouldn't mind seeing that.
Lauren Fleur brushing her teeth. Yeah.
With a rat? Like,
possibly
no.
One of the best things worth watching is Julia Morris and Bondi vet Chris Brown are the hosts.
How do they go with this?
They're bad.
Are they?
They're just not good.
Are they taking it seriously or is it more tongue-in-cheek? Because I thought
sure
if you were a host of this kind of show, you'd be really having a laugh, wouldn't you? Enjoying it, I would imagine.
They are. Someone has written their lines to them, and they are delivering them in such a slapstick manner. I'm hoping that they're taking the mickey out of it as they're doing it. And then somebody had the brilliant idea. Hey, we're in the middle of the Kruger National Park. We can't really afford canned laughter. Why don't we get the 6 crew members to laugh along with every joke? It is the most. It sounds like a bad.
You could have at
party
least got the hyenas to come in. So what do we get?
That's
from
our job.
What do we get from watching all of this? Because clearly a lot of people are.
Yeah, a lot of family audiences, I'd
say.
Yeah,
presumably a lot of people, I imagine, are enjoying it, or at least they're tuning in for something. What is it that they're tuning in for?
Well, the first thing I think is gut-wrenching fun. Again, I mean that quite literally, and I'm not kidding when I say that I literally almost threw up watching this show. In fact, twice I had to leave the room. Now, that that was not because of the hosting, but because of some of the challenges, like, you know, where, like Shane Warne's pureed rat,
for example.
Have a wine glass full of bull's blood and a pig snout.
Please.
You know, and that's some of the nicer things. I could have wished, for a glass of bull's blood with some of the things that were being served up. You know, so that for a start, it's just that whole sort of thrill TV. But there's also something a little sort of self-satisfying about looking behind the curtain. That's what the celebrities are really like when they're sleep deprived and in a sleeping bag in the middle of the jungle. So there's part of that too. But ultimately, I think it's just one of those affirmations that no one can be ultimately down and out for the count. Okay, so you see some people whose careers have been spent, so to speak, and yet there they are still struggling along, and they're going to do some amazing things. They're going to be fantastic. I mean, if there's a philosophy to it, it's basically you can overcome anything, including your stomach.
Sounds like that's appealing to the people. I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here is every weeknight on Network 10 at 7:30, and it's rated PG for mild violence. So depending on your perspective, it stars everyone or no one, as the case may be. Now, Mark, you put a true or false question to us before. What was it?
It was Marlon Brando received the Academy Award for Best Actor in his performance of The Godfather. True or false?
False.
How did you know?
Because I don't think he was nominated for actor on that film, and I think he won for something earlier.
Oh, no.
Or later.
You're false is correct, but false. Because he did win the Academy Award.
For Best Supporting?
No, for Best Actor, for Marlon Brando, for his performance in The Godfather. He did.
He did?
But he didn't receive it.
Oh,
he
yes.
He didn't actually turn up.
He did not.
What he actually did, for those people who might not know, he actually got somebody else to stand in for him, an American Indian, because basically he was protesting the way the Native Americans were being treated.
That's right. I was trying to raid my mind. Oscar archives didn't come to the full there. Anyway, thank you very much for True or False. That'll be back next week. Coming up later in the show, we're going to be talking about Brooklyn, Deadpool, and speaking of comebacks, Mark, career comebacks, I'm going to list off the top 5 best movie comebacks ever.
Welcome back. Well, we're at that part of the show called Soundtrack, where we have a look at sort of the music that has undergirded so many films. And we missed Zoolander 2 because, we won't go into it, but
stop
Russ,
rubbing
it's all
it
your
in.
Fault. But anyway, we'll talk about why later. It was a really good reason. But we thought, okay, we can't go past without acknowledging something. So we're going to touch a little bit on Zoolander, the first one. George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley got the idea for this song from a scribbled note that Andrew Ridgeley from Wham left his parents for some apparent reason while they were out. He made a famous movie moment even better, this sort of hilarious gasoline fight between 4 vapid male models in Zoolander 1, one of whom caps off the scene by deciding to relax with the cigarette and, hey presto, celebrity funeral. The music video introduced us to those Choose Life t-shirts. Do you remember those?
I do.
Oh, of course, I am talking
and
about...
And I did.
You did. I'm talking about Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go by Wham.
Sparking to a flame, yeah. My beats per minute. and tomorrow night. It's cold out there, but it's warm in bed. They can dance.
So there's
Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go went to number one in 15 countries, including the UK, US, and of course Australia in 1984 when it was released. So not surprisingly, it holds the dubious honour of being the first single I ever bought.
Of course it does.
I know, it was a little shameful. I even have the mint. I was actually digging it out of my singles collection last night. I was going to bring it in, but I just thought, why punish yourself? Okay, but I'm not alone. In 2015, the song was actually voted by the British public as the nation's 13th favourite song from the 80s.
13th?
Wouldn't you like to just get a little plaque that said 13th favourite?
Better than 14th, though.
Anyway, that's soundtrack for this week. Well, actually, pushing on into the show, let's play a sting. I never get old. Sorry, I never get old. I do get old, and that gets older every time I do it.
Where are we up to? Showing.
We're up to Now Showing. Nominated for 3 Oscars, including Best Picture and Lead Actress, Brooklyn is an unusually old-fashioned drama about an Irish girl finding a new life in America. With refugee and asylum seeker issues confronting us most nights on the news, what does Brooklyn share with us about the immigration experience and about those who seek to help us settle into it?
Dear Rose, I miss you and Mother and think about you every day. The most important news is that I have a job and I'm in a boarding house.
I was glad to see you finally got some letters from home today.
I wish that I could stop feeling that I want to be an Irish girl in Ireland.
Homesickness is like most sicknesses. It will pass.
Would you dance with me?
I'm not Irish.
So what were you doing at an Irish dance?
I really like Irish girls.
Very honest admission there from a character called Tony in this film. But the film isn't about Tony. It's about Eilish, who's an Irish, young Irish girl in the early 1950s. She's played by a great actress called Saoirse Ronan, who is one of the Oscar nominees out of Brooklyn. And she starts in Ireland, and she is whisked off to Brooklyn to find a better life. Her sister wants a better life for her. There's nothing really going on in her small town in Ireland. So on the boat across to Brooklyn. And then from there, the rest of the movie is sort of charting a course through what Eilish experiences in Brooklyn, and then some drama ensues, Mark, around relationships, and there's a bit of
a love triangle.
And there's a bit of testing going on around where your home is, where your life is across the span of Brooklyn. I'm trying to be vague because there are a couple of key moments in the film that the more you talk about, kind of, it knocks the wind out of sails a little bit if you know going in, but probably the trailer reveals it anyway, I suppose, if you go and have a look at it. But Brooklyn is good, Mark, not great, but a pretty solid kind of 7, 7.5 out of 10.
So it's Twilight.
It's Twilight in the 1950s as the immigration experience and young love. No, it's not. It's way more old-fashioned than that, Mark. This is
how,
like,
old-fashioned is it?
How old-fashioned? Super old-fashioned. Not so much that people will go in and not recognise anything that's going on.
We're not just talking about the fashions. I mean, it's obviously set in the 1950s.
Yeah, so it's very similar to Carol that's on screens at the moment, and you reviewed earlier in the year. And even like Mad Men, that kind of style to some degree. So everything from the look and feel of it, but also this is a movie that's remarkably uncynical, largely for the most part. And it's nice to watch a movie that's nice. There's one sex scene in this movie. There's some bursts of language, but other than that, it's really quite decent, relatively wholesome. Some of the storylines aren't that much, but even for, even though they do diverge into some treacherous relationship waters, the Brooklyn itself is still remarkably nice and decent. And I don't remember too many other movies around like that in recent times.
Is it time for an immigration story? Because, I mean, immigration itself just fills our headlines these days. How does Brooklyn sit with the current global state of trying to live in another country?
You'd think it would be a movie that's possibly got something to say about what's going on in the world today. You would just expect that from a movie being released about immigration and about this time. But Brooklyn doesn't actually have that much to say about the immigrant experience. It's a very you get is a very narrow focused look at immigration. You see it all through the eyes of Eilish, and she is white and is getting an education and can speak the language in this new country she goes to. And when she gets to America, even as a movie that could have been about the American dream, I don't necessarily think it is, but she sort of lives out the American dream and comes to find her place in this new place. She gets a lot of help. She meets a boy who's this guy, Tony, great, played by this great actor called Emery Cohen. I thought he was excellent in the film. And all these things sort of gel for her as she lands in this new country. You and I were part of a special screening of Brooklyn this week. This is why we didn't get to see Zoolander 2.
Because we're next door.
At a preview this week. We're next door to the cinema because we're at Brooklyn. This special Q&A screening that we did with City Bible Forum. And one of the ladies in the crowd, when we were getting some feedback on our thoughts about the film, very helpfully pointed out...
When they stopped throwing things.
When they stopped howling at us about, how dare you? When she was reflecting on Brooklyn, she was saying from her own experience as a migrant to Australia, this is a remarkably sanitized, almost fairy tale-like story of immigration. So no, I don't think Brooklyn has too much to say to speak into the immigration experience right now. That's not what this film's about.
Yeah, well, was her character, though, the one that stuck with you, or was it someone else? Because I know how you felt about the film. You were sort of torn.
Yes and no. Yeah, I am torn. So, yes, the character of Eilish does stick with me, probably not for good reasons, though. In the final sort of third of the film, some of the decisions that she makes I find very questionable in relationships. But to kind of get to that point, there's another character in the film played by Jim Broadbent who's a Catholic priest in this film, and he's one of the better representations on screen of a Christian in a community and being part of a community and being the glue of a community, which we just don't really see nowadays, a Christian leader, let alone being represented positively, but being someone who is big in the community and actually involved in their everyday lives and helping people out. He's very pivotal in the life of Eilish in New York and helps her kind of get to her feet. What I didn't like about the way he's presented on screen, and also then Eilish, this lead character who, it is her movie, it is her story, we're meant to be going along with her, up until probably the last 5 minutes of the movie, maybe the last 2 minutes of the movie, I had a lot of issue with how she's a young woman who's going about trying to work out how to live, but she doesn't really know how to. And no one around her, I felt, was really giving her guidance. And it would have been great if someone had actually attempted to give her a framework with which to look at the world and to work out how she's going to go. She's very easily led, and a lot of her stuff is very reactionary, her thinking. And so she doesn't really think about the future too deeply. She just sort of reacts to situations. In contrast, like, you know, this Father Flood character could have come in with the words of Jesus and given her very helpful guidance based on what Jesus had to say about how to live. Like, for example, some of the things Eilish does, I think, leads some people astray. And in contrast to that, Jesus says, think about that. Don't lead people astray. Why? Not just because it's better for you, because you don't want to be tempted and you don't want to be yourself led astray. But if you can not lead other people astray, it's better for harmonious relationships and better for the long term, better for the future. And it's just a better way to live. So if that sort of guidance had been presented in Brooklyn, I think these characters would have stuck with me a lot more instead of leaving me with this tension around the decision-making that was going on in Brooklyn. So while it gets a very strong rating, a very positive rating from me, there's a lot to consider about the guidance that's offered about how you go about navigating life and relationships.
There's huge amounts to think of in the film, though. And it's kind of funny because you've talked and talked and talked about this film. I'm glad that we're actually being able to share it. But look, Brooklyn stars Saoirse Ronan, Emery Cohen, and Domhnall Gleeson, and is now showing at a cinema conveniently located somewhere nearabouts you. Rated M for coarse language and a brief sex scene. It is brief, and it's frankly unnecessary, given how steadfastly old-fashioned most of Brooklyn is.
Two of the people that joined us at the Brooklyn screening the other night were Russ Matthews and Adrian Drayton, who are regulars on this show. And Adrian's going to be turning up a little bit later in this show. But go to insights.uca.org.au, the website that they work for, and check out both Russ's review of Brooklyn and then other articles that are published on that site that Adrian looks after on immigration. You can go and check those out now.
And still to come, Marvel's, well, most hard-to-handle hero, Deadpool, and also more material on the sort of comebacks you'd like to see in film.
Welcome back. Now, Mark and I don't have our own gold-class cinema where the only ticket holders are Mark and Ben.
But we should.
But that's not a true story, no.
Actually, I do. Anyway.
But we actually love to mix it up with the people, though, Mark.
Yes.
We love to mix it up with you guys, which is what we did this week at this special screening of Brooklyn that we were speaking about earlier. Now, after the movie, Mark and I got to share our thoughts with the crowd. But for the press record segment this week, we got the crowd to share their thoughts on Brooklyn with all of us.
Certainly a bit of a chick flick. I think that it was an idealist's ending, I think, and we all like that. We like to think that if we were in that position, we would have made the same decision. And maybe in the 1950s, that's realistic. Maybe in this day and age, you know, she might have gone, oh, here's a wealthy guy. You know, I can support my mother here. Of course, girls tend to be a bit more family orientated as well. And the connections there and that kind of thing. I'm glad it ended like that because I think there's a big part of us that all thinks, you know, that was the right moral thing to do. And we'd like to think if we were in that position that we'd do the same.
This movie showed the right thing happened in the end, and it was, in my mind, it was like a parable between the way from our youth we can pledge our life to Jesus and then get drawn back into the old world and get wooed back by, you know, the old comfortable side of things. But there's so much more for us, and the right thing is always the right thing, which is to go back to Jesus.
So tell me, what did you think of the film? Did you enjoy it?
Absolutely. It was so refreshing to see a completely different film in terms of a time period, the values, community, and I think my take home is faithfulness and help and love in all its different forms. It's got that nice old-fashioned feel of duty, obligation, family, but yet knowing that there's something that she just had to do for herself.
I do think that, you know, going back to the movie itself, I think that she felt perhaps a little bit pressured. And I think in the 1950s, you know, women didn't really feel like they had the same kind of independent voice to be able to, you know, decide for themselves. It was always like, hey, get married as soon as you can so that the guy can provide for you and this kind of thing. You know, from that side, I kind of thought, you know, she was pressured into it. And so she didn't really have the option to go back in that case and be with the guy Jim in Ireland as such. So it was a very multi-layered movie. And so it's very complex, and I think it stirs up a lot of opinions and emotions in us, which is of course why it's so highly rated and why it is such a great movie.
I did enjoy the movie, actually. I was crying, you know, I'm a chick, so.
Oh, good, so I wasn't the only one.
No. I think the life lesson is don't flirt with the temptation of having even, you know, an affair once you're married, whether it's for 1 minute or 20 years. Yeah, don't even think of even just going there, because once you've opened that door, then it's just, you're causing just a big web of deceit and lies and obviously.
I like how you say web, because it's not just you, it's everybody else who's drawn
right.
into it.
That's right, it's a community, it's your family and so and marriage is a, you know, nowadays, you know, someone has to stand up for it.
That's some of what you had to say about Brooklyn after the special Q&A screening that Mark and I were at earlier this week.
What a smart audience.
They were
very smart.
For people to be able to summarize movies like that so quickly after the movie puts me to shame a little bit.
I go, it was
pretty good, yeah. I think.
Oh, I like it.
Let's go get something to eat. Moving right along then to our next now showing choice for this week, Deadpool. Deadpool? Who is Deadpool? If you're not a Marvel comic fan, you can be forgiven for not knowing who Deadpool is. But Deadpool has long been celebrated by many comic lovers as the ultimate anti-hero. Thing is, though, when Mark went to see Deadpool's own movie, he discovered there's much more traditional hero under the surface if you choose to peel back his blood-soaked mask.
I love you, Wade Wilson. We can fight this.
You're right. The cancer's only in my liver, lungs, prostate, and brain. All things I can live without.
What if I told you we can make you better? You're a fighter. We can give you abilities most men only dream of. Make you a superhero.
You just promise you'll do right by me, so I can do right by someone else.
And please don't make the super suit green or animated.
Based on Marvel Comics' most unconventional antihero, Deadpool tells the origin story of former Special Forces operative turned merc, or mercenary for those who don't know the lingo.
Who knows the lingo?
Wade Wilson, who after being subjected to a rogue experiment that leaves him with accelerated healing powers, adopts his alter ego, Deadpool. Armed with his new abilities and a dark, twisted sense of humour, Deadpool hunts down the man who nearly destroyed his life. Well, look, Deadpool's played by Ryan Reynolds, who had his, you know, horrible first superhero outing with Green Lantern.
Oh, that's a movie we should never speak of again.
In fact, actually, that'll be the last time until when I finally mention it a little later in the show. He does an excellent job as the lewd, acid-tongued, irreverent, basically psychotic superhero. That's right. This is very true to the comic, so be warned, okay? Deadpool is risque, to say the least, okay? He's a character who is not afraid of saying exactly what he's thinking, and sometimes the things he's thinking he probably shouldn't be thinking. So it is a brilliant story, though, strangely, because Reynolds lives up to probably being the happiest exchange with the Green Lantern that he's ever had. The film is violent, but never pointlessly so. It's irreverent, but it laughs at itself as much as anything else. The wit is sharp and as deadly as Deadpool's twin katanas.
Wow, so you're giving us a lot of warnings, but you're also suggesting it's watchable at the same time.
Yeah, this is one of those...
But approach with caution, I'm taking it.
I know, this is one of those cases where, look, I didn't know what to think, because honestly, I found it incredibly entertaining. At the same time, there's a lot in it where you just go, oh, yikes, please.
Pretty big challenge as a viewer.
I know. Yeah, so it's challenging. It's one of those cases where it's kind of like The Hateful Eight, okay? There's a lot in it that you've got to be very cautious of to take anybody to, or in fact, to go and see yourself. It's certainly no Captain America, okay? That's for sure. The language is not sickening, but very street level. The violence is cartoonish, but it's kind of graphic at places. The character is lewd and tormented, but that's kind of part of the storyline, and that's who he is.
So if your kids, and especially your younger kids, have been lining up to see a lot of the other Marvel films, everything from Guardians of the Galaxy to Thor to Iron Man, Avengers, Captain America, as you just mentioned,
yeah.
Are you suggesting they
scoot them out of the line and take them to Brooklyn?
Yeah. They'll love it. Okay, look, 1950s story of love and love triangles.
I think a mature viewer wouldn't have, you know, would be able to get through this film and would enjoy it for what it is. But this is the sort of stuff that crosses a movie off the list for many people. So just bear that in mind. I wouldn't be arguing either. If it's not your sort of thing, that's okay.
And it's also a movie that's very good at taking shots at other movies and itself and comic books and all those kind of things. Really, like, tears them down and fills them up at the same time.
One of the classic things that Deadpool does, both in his comics and in this film, is he breaks the fourth wall, which basically means he does a lot of talking to the audience. You know, you're in a film, it's very aware of itself, and so it's very, very funny, but at the same time, yeah, look, there's a lot of stuff to be cautious about.
So it sounds like you quite liked the movie. And so the longer you're going along watching it, what's the attraction of Deadpool, which must be one of the uncatchiest names of a superhero ever? What's the attraction of Deadpool as a superhero? We mentioned at the start he's like the ultimate anti-hero. So where does he sit in the entire universe of superheroes? He's an X-Men, isn't he? Or might be an X-Men?
That's the thing. You see, he basically undercuts this saccharine sweet Marvel superhero that we've been sold. You know, and look, that's fun because, I mean, it's good to watch an Iron Man or a Captain America, and the Avengers can be cool. But when you look at them in real life, you just go, who gets on like that? Who can think that way? Who wanders around pondering these big topics and taking the world on
their shoulders?
Well,
aren't you, at the end of the day, a vigilante, Iron Man or Captain America, or insert any other superhero there?
And Deadpool basically goes, I'm a vigilante.
Yeah.
Don't mind me.
Straight
up. I'm just going to go do this, if you don't mind. There's some great interaction between him and the whole X-Men background. You know, he turns up the X-Men mansion and says, you know, it's decidedly empty. Like, it was because we couldn't afford in this film to put any more characters in. You know, and it's true. It's very funny like that. So there's a lot of this.
Kind of superhero is this guy?
Well, he's not a bad guy.
He's not? He sort of sounds like he is.
He's presented as a bad guy, but they've done one of the Simpsons twists. You know, when the Simpsons came out, a lot of parents got really kind of worried. They went, oh my goodness, you know, there's Bart saying, eat my shorts every couple of seconds. I don't want my kids, you know, doing that.
Eating their shorts or telling other people to.
Ridiculous. Yes. It's so unsanitary. And yet the truth is that the Simpsons undergirded a whole lot of traditional family values. There's mum and dad who went through a whole, you know, a lot of marriage stresses, but Homer and Marge were never going to break up. You know, they're always going to be there for the kids. Even the wisdom, the crazy wisdom that comes out of Homer's life makes a certain sort of sense in the end, and Deadpool's like that. He's not, you know, overweight and sitting on a couch somewhere and eating pork rinds. He's basically still doing heroic things.
But he is a bad guy though, Mark, isn't he? Like, before he turns into Deadpool, isn't he a mercenary? He's a hired gun for money. Isn't he a thug that goes around trying to debt collect?
Yeah.
And then when he becomes Deadpool and gets his superpowers, isn't he out for revenge? Doesn't he do all kinds of bad things? Like, how can you say he's not a bad guy?
Because it's like the actions that in some contexts can be described as bad, also in different contexts can actually turn out to be quite good.
But in his context though, isn't he still thinking he's doing the wrong thing?
I don't think so. I think actually that Deadpool...
Really?
Yeah, underneath the surface, I think he's the sort of guy who's determined that justice has got to be done. I mean, isn't that Captain America?
Is it justice for himself or justice for everybody else?
Yeah, I feel like he's got other people in mind too. Like, he looks at some of these villains and says, these guys can't keep going on. Sure, I'm going to start with all the terrible things you've done to me, but, you know, in the end, you can't walk the streets.
Wow.
I don't know. Deadpool, okay, so, I mean, you can see we've got a bit of a back and forth about this.
Well, it sounds like there's just a lot to discuss and think through as you approach Deadpool. And as you remind us, it is a cautionary tale, so we're cautioning you about this tale. It's rated MA 15+, for strong violence and a sex scene. The humor's very risque, as you've told us. Deadpool is an anti-hero of the First Order, so be very, very careful if you're impressionable or thinking of taking someone impressionable along. Who's my impressionable friend that I can take to see Deadpool?
Unless you want to mess them up for life. Okay, moving on. In the show coming up, we've actually got the Bible Society's Greg Clark coming up to talk to us about resurrection. And then jumping off that, we're going to hear about Ben's top 5 comeback films.
Welcome back to the show. On next week's show, here's a big pointer for what's coming up. We're going to be talking about Risen, which is a major new release that presents the most famous resurrection in history, Jesus, from the perspective of someone who wants to prove it's a hoax. What's all this fuss about Jesus and the resurrection, we hear you say? Well, that's a very good question, and we're about to answer it. Well, we're not going to. It's a good thing we've got Bible Society Australia's CEO and social commentator Greg Clark on hand to tell us what the Bible has to say about all that stuff to do with resurrection.
For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. This extraordinary saying from the Gospel of Matthew refers to the Bible story of Jonah. You probably know the story a little bit. A man, Jonah, is sent by God to deliver a great message to a city called Nineveh. It's been in the news a bit recently. But he's refusing to do it. Eventually, he's compelled to go, and on the way there, he gets swallowed by a huge whale, but protected by God as he learns the lesson of who is really in control of the world. Well, the book of Jonah is an astonishing account of one man's spiritual journey, a journey from pride to humility, a journey from self-protection to seeing God's generosity to those in deep need, and a journey from death back to life as he's rescued from the sea in the belly of the whale. And this Jonah tale has been important for plenty of other tales. Think of Moby Dick, for example, where Captain Ahab is hunting down the great white whale who represents all the things in life that can't be controlled. Well, Jesus uses the Jonah story to make at least 2 points to the religious leaders who were listening to him talk. Firstly, he says, it doesn't matter how religious you are. If you're not honestly seeking to do God's will, then God will judge you. They're hard words that cut to the heart. But there's no room for religious hypocrites, says Jesus. Trust me, says God. And secondly, Jesus makes the point that he himself is greater than Jonah. The Son of Man, just like Jonah, will spend 3 days and 3 nights, but in the heart of the earth. That's what he's predicting in Matthew, that he will rise from the dead, that he will be dead like Jonah in the sea, but then will return. The impossible will happen because he's greater than the prophet Jonah. Christians believe in what others find impossible, that the great Jesus Christ rose from the dead, and that because he rose from the dead, those who believe in him can also have faith beyond the grave. That, if you'll excuse me, is a whale of a story.
And that actually takes us on to something else that's actually a whale of a story. Risen,
yes.
Risen next week is an incredible epic story, and it plays off the whole idea of Jesus' resurrection. And so if you're looking for a sort of a preview of what we'll be talking about next week, you can dig out a copy of this month's edition of Eternity, where we actually take a look at, in fact, to be honest, I take a look at Risen as a review, and I look at the key arguments the film puts forward as to why Jesus' resurrection can't be dismissed by skeptics. It's a kind of really interesting film in that respect, a drama and also a teaching tool.
And also, as a pointer to next week's show, I mentioned earlier in the show that Adrian Drayton from Insights Magazine will be joining us on this show. I was incorrect, because we were joined this week by Greg Clark. Adrian will be up next week because he's going to be talking to us about what TV box set would he take to a desert island?
Oh, the anticipation.
Oh, man, it's a pretty good question, right? I'm glad we came up with it.
So long as it has electricity.
It's that time of the show, Mark, coming to an end of another edition of The Big Picture. And the way we always like to go out.
It's always a bit sad. And then I remember it's the top five.
And then you cheer up again. And this week's top five is the biggest comeback roles of all time. Greg Clark just spoke to us about Resurrection. We're thinking a little bit about what Resurrection can look like on screen, and particularly what it can look like in the careers of individuals.
Five.
Drew Barrymore was a child star. In the 80s.
She was indeed.
In movies such as E.T. and Firestarter. She really kind of kicked off this little curly-haired moppet, a little bit like Shirley Temple back in the day.
Without the dancing.
And then, poor old Drew, eh? She got into a bit of strife with drugs and went off the rails a little bit, like some other child stars can do. But then, unlike a lot of other child stars who then just continue to go off the rails and you never really see them again, Drew Barrymore kind of came back. Like, she was on the way back before this role that I'm about to mention, but she'd done a few films like Batman Forever, Boys on the Side, Everyone Says I Love You. She was in a Woody Allen movie, for goodness sake. But she still hadn't really become what she then became. And what really put her back on the map? 1996's Scream.
Yes.
Scream. And she was only in that film for, like, let's say 10 minutes, something like that.
Long enough to scream.
But she was the opening sequence of that. And it was one of the most memorable cameos, I think, in modern times. People really remember her sequence at the start of Scream, which kicked off that incredible kind of comedy horror film. Drew Barrymore came back from Nowheresville, roughly speaking, with Scream in that opening cameo shot. And then she went on to do The Wedding Singer, which then pretty much tipped her into what she became, which is a romantic comedy star of, let's say, middling returns or different.
I don't know.
Not like, always good returns.
Of a particular type, though, like Bridget Jones' Diary. Like, it was just perfect.
But that was Renee Zellweger.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with Drew Barrymore, who was also in Never Been Kissed and Riding in Cars with Boys.
There you go.
Four.
Go ahead, please. Clearly, I need my own comeback.
In the 60s, Mark, you can remember the 60s, can you not? Out of all the people in this room, you can remember the 60s.
If I could remember anything, it would be the 60s.
In the 60s, one of the big film stars around was a guy called Christopher Lee, who later became Sir Christopher Lee. He was big in Hammer horror films, particularly. He was the screen Dracula for a long, long time, and pretty much still remains that way. But then he slipped into relative obscurity in the mid to late 1970s. He only did sort of faltering Disney productions and things like Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf.
not as good as Howling 4.
your brother-in-law is a zombie. And he was also in the seventh and last installment of the Police Academy series, Mission to Moscow. So Christopher Lee wasn't, like, he from where he'd been to where he got to, it wasn't going very well. But his career comeback came in 2001 with the first installment of the Lord of the Rings trilogy, where he was cast by Peter Jackson into Middle Earth as Saruman, the evil counterpart to Ian McKellen's Gandalf. And so getting Christopher Lee up on screen as this sort of evil wizard guy effectively brought Christopher Lee back in from the wilderness. And he then became this distinguished British guy for hire, particularly in Tim Burton movies. He was in loads of Tim Burton movies. He passed away last year, I think, Christopher Lee. And he was also Count Dooku in the Star Wars prequels as well.
Yeah, if you can basically have The Lord of the Rings and Star Wars as your credits, that's enough.
I know, right? So a guy who, talk about screen resurrections, like for a guy who was in Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf, to being in loads of Tim Burton films as well as The Lord of the Rings and Star Wars.
I particularly liked him in The Martian.
He was in The Martian?
Oh, that was Matt Damon.
Three.
It's a good thing you're not doing this list. Okay, in the
19... But talk about comebacks.
In the 1980s, a comedy was somewhat owned to a fair degree by Eddie Murphy. 48 Hours, Beverly Hills Cop, Trading Places, Coming to America. Eddie Murphy smashed it. Then the 1990s, not so much. Mm. He was making movies, you remember these? Life, Metro, Boomerang.
Oh, that was awful.
Distinguished Gentleman, Holy Man. My goodness, what did that guy do? He just sort of seemed to single-handedly grab his career and just choke it, choke the life out of it, life. And out of all these progressive roles that he had in the 1990s, he came back with Shrek, but I wanted to pick... But he's actually a guy, and this is why he's on the list at number three. He's a good example of multiple career resurrections because he did come back with Shrek as Donkey. Loads of people, including kids, like loved his stuff. But then he kind of proceeded to go downhill after that because he thought he was going to be a child star. And he made movies like Haunted Mansion or Dr. Dolittle 2. Or did you ever see Pluto Nash?
No one saw Pluto Nash.
Like, no,
or you saw Pluto Nash.
That's one of the biggest box office failures of all time. I think it cost something like $120 million to make and it made $2 at the cinema. Mm. And he was in that. He was a star of that. So he came back with Shrek, went down again. But then he resurrected, and this is why he's on the list, in 2001 with Dreamgirls.
Yes.
He came back in Dreamgirls and got Oscar nominated for that. And effectively what was a James Brown ripoff on screen. That it was Eddie Murphy being James Brown. Very, very, like, great work. It looked like Eddie Murphy. It wasn't comedy, but it could demonstrate that he could do something and could perform well again. That was excellent. What was the next film that he made? Norbit. Norbit. So Eddie Murphy on this top five of comeback roles gets in at number three because...
For three comebacks.
He's done it a number of times. So I reckon any day now, Eddie Murphy's going to come back. He's been in the wilderness for a while. He must be playing his return.
Time to come back.
And then a few dud films after that. I think, Mark, you will be surprised that who I'm about to say next isn't at number one on this list because I think most people, when they think about career resurrections, particularly in modern times, will think about this guy. The guy who was at the front of Grease and Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, John Travolta.
That old guy. That's right. Now, Grease and Saturday Night Fever, sort of late 70s, early 80s. He was a massive, massive star at the time. Then what happened? Well, he
took his dancing too seriously.
I don't know what he took too seriously. Maybe he was flying too many Qantas planes because he was not reading scripts, I think, at least not reading good ones, because he did Look Who's Talking and its sequels, which progressively got lamer and lamer. And then after that, it's like, who can remember what he was doing? I don't think he was really doing much of anything. And then a guy who I was reading some articles online, and someone very accurately described Quentin Tarantino as, if your career is in the toilet, he's like the fairy godmother or godfather who will come along and rescue your career. And he's done that with people like...
It's more like the Brothers Grimm.
He's a bit Brothers Grimm. He did that with people like Harvey Keitel with Reservoir Dogs, Pam Grier in Jackie Brown, David Carradine in Kill Bill, and Kurt Russell with Death Proof as well. But Quentin Tarantino's biggest career resurrection for someone has to be John Travolta in Pulp Fiction, 1994's Pulp Fiction, which like almost made people forget that John Travolta had done anything else before, even Grease and Saturday Night Fever. It eclipsed his entire career by being cast as this globe-trotting, very eloquent hitman alongside Samuel L. Jackson in Pulp Fiction. Incredible.
And he got a dance scene.
I thought that was going to be the most famous modern example that I could find until... One. I've slotted this in at number one, Mike, because it's both a professional choice and a personal one as well, because I've met this guy, and I met this guy for the particular role that I'm about to talk about. Robert Downey Jr.
Was
a really big star back in like the 90s. So he was even Oscar nominated for playing Charlie Chaplin in about 1992. But then... A little bit like Drew Barrymore, but more in spectacular
way
fashion.
Way off the rails.
And through sort of the 90s and into the early 2000s, he was actually starring in Ally McBeal at the time or around the same time. But in and amongst that, he was constantly kind of getting arrested, going back into rehab, being busted for drugs, repeat. He even got charged with breaking into his next door neighbor's house and sleeping in one of their beds.
Hmm.
The
wrong bed.
Why would you even do that? Anyway, so Robert Downey Jr.
was
basically like not down for the count, but he from being a leading man, he was something like an interesting bit player that you get into films. He was on the march back though after Ally McBeal in the early 2000s with films like Zodiac and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. But what really set his name in lights and effectively shot his career into, like, talk about a second season of a career, but then shooting you into the stratosphere of stars, Iron Man.
Hmm.
Iron Man, and I think people can forget how massive a gamble in 2008 Iron Man was. Marvel, as we've already talked about in this show with Deadpool, Marvel has since then come to dominate superheroes on
largely
screen.
Largely because of Iron Man.
But largely because of what Iron Man did. And then you think about how big a risk that was for Disney to bank on this guy. Go back to what we just said about rehab and drug charges and all these kinds of things. And the fact that he wasn't a huge name. He wasn't a guy who sold, put on posters to sell movies and that kind of thing. I got to meet Robert Downey Jr. for Iron Man when he came to tour in Sydney. And he knew how fortunate he was about getting this part in this film. But he was all very arrogant. It was a little, it was very showy as well. It was, I think he was smoking a cigar during the whole interview. But he was also very grateful, very gracious about that. So he comes in at number one as my career comebacks list. Because as I was thinking about this list, I was thinking about what deeper point can we take away from this? What can we possibly learn? What's this an illustration of? I think, put simply, it's a great illustration of how it's never too late to come back to God. It's never too late. Like, if you think it's all finished and all done and you're never going to get resurrected again in terms of like your person and being a better person, all those kind of things, you can never turn things around. You can always go back to God. So if this list teaches us nothing else apart from that stars can do it, I think it shows us as an illustration that it's never too late to come back. So,
Mr. Stark, please.
Yes, dear.
Could I have your attention?
Absolutely.
Our priority here is to have you turn over the Iron Man weapon to the American people.
Well, you can forget it. We're safe. America is secure. You want my property? You can't have it. But I did you a big favor. I have successfully privatized world peace.
We're adjourned for the day. You've been a delight.
Okay, give me a smooch for good luck. I might not make it back.
That's actually a grab from Iron Man 2, but still fits the point. Number one choice on the comeback list this week, Robert Downey Jr., Iron Man.
Well, what's coming up next week?
Mate, we are going to be watching other people on their first dates, which is a little bit awkward much.
Well, we'll make it so with first date. And what Risen tells us about Jesus' resurrection and believing in it.
And Will Smith leads a based on a true story drama about speaking out against an enormous corporation. And that week, like this week, I'm still going to be Ben McKechnie.
And I'm still Mark Hadley. Thanks very much and see you next week.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's Word into every corner of your world.